Radio.
Redefining Marriage, Its Impact on Religious Liberty. A talk by Rocco Mimmo.
Well, thanks everyone for coming tonight. One of the things, Angela, I didn't mention is that I have the distinction of also being the Junior Vice President of the St. Thomas More Society at the moment, so I'm very pleased to be here sort of in both capacities. When I get the opportunity to speak about subjects that I feel very strongly about, I like to seize those opportunities. So as well as introducing Rocky, there's a few other things that I'd like to say about tonight's topic. So it might take a little while, Rocky, so if you'd like to sit down, you're most welcome to. So thanks everyone for coming. So the topic for tonight is same-sex marriage, its impact on religious liberty. And Rocky, who's going to be speaking to us, is definitely one of Australia's foremost and most tireless campaigners for religious freedom. Being the founder and chairman of the Ambrose Centre for Religious Liberty, and if you follow any governmental inquiries, whether they're state, territorial or federal, you'll find submissions from Rocky on most important moral issues and putting a very sound submission each time. As I said, I just wanted to make a few comments before Rocky takes over, because as you know, there's been a long-running campaign to redefine marriage in Australia under the slogan of marriage equality. And this campaign really seems to have picked up an even greater head of steam following the results of the Irish referendum on that topic and following the decision of the United States Supreme Court by a majority of 5-4. In the decision of Obergefell and Hodges to require all American states to permit and to recognise as marriage, marriages between two persons of the same sex. For the last week, actually, I've been in Utah. And every time I go to the United States and go to the different states of the United States, it just brings home to me how incredibly different that country is. We think of it as some kind of amorphous collection of people, but think of people living in New York, people living in Washington, and people who live in Salt Lake City, you're talking about people who have got really not much in common. So the decision of the United States Supreme Court did receive quite a bit of media attention in Australia, but only the decision, the outcome, rather than what the decision actually said, and rather than looking at particularly what some of the judges who weren't in the majority had to say. Of course, the Australian Constitution is very different to the United States Constitution. And it will also appear from the judgment that there are substantial differences in the two countries' current societal attitudes to de facto couples and to children born out of wedlock. Because in Australia, nobody cares about that question. If children are at school, nobody asks them whether their parents are married or not married or anything like that. It's not an issue in Australia. And in relation to the differential treatment of couples based on their marital status and sexual orientation, as I'm sure most, if not all of you know, in Australia, same-sex couples and opposite-sex couples in relationships for 2 years and more are treated in absolutely identical ways. So there's no discrimination of any kind between those two forms of relationship, whether in relation to tax treatment or any other form of treatment. That's not necessarily the case in the United States. So in Australia, state and federal reforms to a range of provisions have been made to encompass same-sex couples without any change to the definition of marriage. And it's the definition of marriage which is the issue for the moment. So in Australia, as you know, the Coalition has decided that the question of whether or not same-sex marriage will be introduced in Australia will be put to the people in a plebiscite. I suspect there'll be a lot of political twists and turns before that occurs, if it ultimately does. If the issue does proceed to a plebiscite, hopefully the media will be required to carry information for and against the proposal, and the Australian people will be given the opportunity to consider the issues in a more holistic manner than it has been possible to do at the moment, where a couple of commercial channels have refused to carry advertisements putting the case for the preservation of the traditional meaning of marriage, and in a more holistic manner than it's possible for a court to do. Whilst the result in the Obergefell decision has been well publicised, as I said, the judgments considered a range of issues, and those issues have received scant, if any, attention in Australia to date, and that's what I particularly want to talk about. It seems to me that an appropriate starting point for any discussion about altering the meaning of an institution which is so fundamental to society as marriage might be the purpose and meaning of marriage. Why is the state involved in marriage, and what is the purpose and meaning of marriage? What do we actually mean by that term? The majority and minority judgments in Obergefell address this question, but the different answers to it really drive their conclusions. And as I said, strangely, there's been very little discussion in Australia and also in the United States about this foundational question. What is marriage? Why is the state involved in marriage? And has the meaning of marriage changed in some way? What do we want it to mean? And why is the state involved? Justice Alito, who is one of the minority judges, describes the traditional view of marriage as being between one man and one woman as inextricably linked to procreation. Whilst the majority do note that one of the principles of marriage is that marriage safeguards children and families and thus draws meaning from related rights of childbearing, procreation and education, and that it affords permanency and stability important to children's best interests, they relegate childbearing to being only one of the aspects of marriage. Essentially, they dismiss the importance of this aspect of marriage in their finding that an ability, desire or promise to procreate is not and has not ever been a prerequisite for a valid marriage in any United States state. But none of the judges in Obergefell really adequately address the traditional or conjugal view of marriage, which is, of course, about much more than childbearing, childbearing intention or childbearing potential. It is true that only one man and one woman can, by their own sexual union, generate a child. It's also true that this can be an intended or an unintended result, and that even couples believe themselves to be infertile, they sometimes conceive unexpectedly. The traditional conjugal or comprehensive view of marriage is an understanding of marriage which applies equally whether or not children are the result or can result. It is precisely the differences, physical, emotional, and spiritual, between a man and a woman which enables the lifelong, exclusive, monogamous, comprehensive, bodily, emotional, and spiritual union of traditional comprehensive or conjugal marriage. Whilst, of course, this is a Catholic understanding of marriage, it's not an understanding of marriage which is founded solely on religious beliefs. Justice Alito's observation that the traditional meaning of marriage may sound unfamiliar to many in the United States today is probably also true in Australia. No-fault divorce, readily accessible contraception and abortion, the equivalence in treatment of married and de facto couples, and the rise in the number of children born outside of wedlock have all impacted on the understanding of marriage. However, the traditional or conjugal meaning of marriage is completely consistent with the current definition of marriage in the Marriage Act 1961, and it is completely inconsistent with same-sex marriage and with any other forms of marriage. Principles of marriage identified by the majority in Obergefell focus primarily on personal choice, companionship, understanding, what they strangely describe as being the transcendent purpose of marriage, and the fulfillment of the married couple. Some have called this the revisionist view of marriage. On this view of marriage, gender is completely irrelevant. The traditional and the revisionist views of marriage are obviously incompatible with each other. Which of these views of marriage should be endorsed by the state is a fundamental question which should be expressly addressed in considering any change to the meaning of marriage in the Marriage Act. The future expansion of the scope of marriage. Gender and number are fundamental in the traditional or conjugal meaning of marriage, as we've seen. If, as in Obergefell, the revisionist view of marriage is adopted, careful consideration will need to be given to whether other forms of marriage, such as polygamy, should also be recognised. Given polygamy's historical, religious and traditional roots in the Lebanese Muslim community and in Indigenous communities in Australia, a fair, rational, non-discriminatory and logical basis on which that and any other form of marriage should continue to be excluded from recognition in Australia will need to be formulated if that is to continue to be the case, if the traditional meaning of marriage is amended. As Chief Justice Roberts observed in Obergefell, it was difficult to see any logical basis, giving the majority's reasoning in that case, on which the court might refuse future recognition of polygamy. And there's a case involving that question which the United States Supreme Court should be considering shortly if they give it permission to be heard. There's been little discussion in Australia of the religious freedom implications of introducing same-sex marriage, and Rocky's going to talk about that, although Australia's Human Rights Commissioner, Tim Wilson, has recently written on the issue. And tonight we're doing something to promote discussion on this critical area. The complaints to Tasmania's Anti-Discrimination Commissioner by Martine Delaney against the Catholic Archbishop of Hobart, Archbishop Julian Porteous, in relation to the distribution of the Catholic Bishop of Australia's pastoral letter on same-sex marriage, don't mess with marriage, in Tasmanian Catholic schools and parishes, suggests that even the religious freedom to teach and advocate, which was referred to as requiring protection by the majority in Obergefell, but criticised as inadequate by that court's minority judgments, is already under threat in Australia. So whilst the United States Supreme Court decision in Obergefell is not directly relevant to, in a legal sense in Australia, it is well worth reading, or at least reading my short on the case summary of the decision, which is available on the Notre Dame School of Law website, as the decision may provide a good springboard for further consideration of some of the issues relevant to the same-sex marriage debate in Australia. Now, let me introduce Rocky Mimmo. Rocky's a Sydney-based lawyer. He has a master's degree in international law from the University of New South Wales, my alma mater. His postgraduate master's studies included an emphasis on human rights law. He's married with 8 children. He has devoted his adult life to working on social issues and running organisations attempting to influence public decision makers on critical moral, social issues and discrimination laws. On these social moral issues, Rocky works in the background around politics. Although not party politically aligned, he can boast to being very well connected. Well, he's boasted in the, what he sent to me, to being very well connected to both sides of politics at the federal and state level. Rocky has made many submissions to parliamentary committees and published articles arguing the case for religious liberty and human rights. He's the human rights advisor to the Canadian-based international human rights organisation Protection of Conscience Project. And if you think Australia is in need of human rights protections for religious liberty, it's nothing compared to what's happened in Canada. After many years of involvement in the moral social issues and noticing the decline and deterioration of religious and cultural values, Rocky founded the Ambrose Centre for Religious Liberty in 2007. And it was launched in Sydney in April 2009. So let's now welcome Rocky.
Thank you very much, Michael, and thank you to Angelo Pardo for taking the initiative in bringing tonight's meeting, and also the those sponsors who were good enough to put their name to the meeting. It's just amazing how people with the best of intentions and common purpose can disagree with predictions of where we're going and where we're not going. When I prepared to talk for tonight, I acted on 2 premises. One is that everyone will be young. Compared to me, that is very true. And secondly, that we will have same-sex marriage in Australia by within a couple of years. I don't think for one moment that there is a silent majority against same-sex marriage anymore. No more than I think in America today that there really is a silent majority against same-sex marriage. Rightly so, there has been a strong voice against the decision of the Supreme Court. Rightly so. That would not happen in Australia. In Australia, our High Court has already determined that marriage, as the word applies in the Constitution, can in fact mean polygamy, can in fact mean any other forms of consensual relationships between more than 2 people. The one thing about polygamy we should always keep in mind that it's always a man and a woman. many women, but only one man. So there's a discriminatory basis of that, a very unfair, and in fact a very unchristian view of that sort of relationship on the basis that women are not treated as equals. But when we go beyond a man and a woman to two men and one woman, or two women and one man, then that's a different sort of relationship. So I think that what's important, the second part of why how I prepared to talk tonight, was to work on this premise, to put before you, why is it that you, and I presume everybody in this room shares this view, that you oppose same-sex marriage? That is one of the questions. And it's on the answers that you give as sometimes why discrimination laws are applied against us, and why discrimination laws increasingly are secularized. Now, I'll try and make out the argument as best I can. So the topic for tonight is religious liberty threatened in the event of same-sex marriage? Now, I'll give some examples. Michael was very good in terms of, given the presentation he did, he concentrated mainly on America. And the examples that I draw on here are as a result of changes in the law to the definition of marriage, but also the application of discrimination laws in America. Understand, and Michael made the point, that the laws in America are very different to the laws in Australia and how they operate. First of all, marriage in America is not a federal issue. It is a state-based issue. Marriage in Australia is a federal issue. It's a Commonwealth issue. Only the Commonwealth has powers under the Constitution to define what marriage means. And that power to define rests not with the High Court, but with the Federal Parliament. And this is the point that the Federal Parliament, that the High Court of Australia made 2 years ago, that whatever the Federal Parliament decides marriage shall be, then that shall be marriage. So that does not apply in America. The Supreme Court took that function. Now, the Supreme Court applied the decision based on what's called the 14th Amendment. The 14th Amendment is, of course, the equal opportunities, the equivalent of our discrimination laws. It's the equal protection amendment to the Constitution, where every person must have equal rights. And for those of you who may not be aware of the origins of the 14th Amendment, it arose after the Civil War, and it was put in place in order to protect the blacks and to prevent the extension of the prevention of slavery. Now, we've gone a long way from protecting a race-based initiative to protecting everybody's rights, and that's precisely what's happening in Australia in terms of our discrimination laws. Once upon a time, discrimination laws were clearly based on personal characteristics, things from which you could not change. The only exception to that was religious belief. Amazing. You can change your religious belief. But what the framers of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights and then the International Covenant of Civil and Political Rights decided that religious belief had such a force that it could move people to do enormous acts. And the evidence for that can be seen more recently. The number of Christians who have gone to their death in different parts of the Middle East, in Pakistan, even in Indonesia. The number of Buddhist monks who went to their death rather than renounce their beliefs. It has an enormous force. And so the international instruments on human rights always recognise that religious belief had the same quality as a personal characteristic that could not be changed. But from there, we've moved a long way to include some of the matters that Michael spoke about, sexual orientation, sexual identity, and so on. So understand, when I go through this paper, that what we are combating is a secularised perversion, if you like, of what discrimination laws were all about, including questions of equality between people. So the examples from the States that I was to draw on include the cake makers refusing to bake a cake for the celebration of a same-sex marriage ceremony. A US photographer in New Mexico refused to take photographs at a same-sex wedding ceremony. Or, more recently, the county clerk in Kentucky, Kim Davis, was jailed because she refused to issue marriage licenses for same-sex couples. Now, these examples will become more commonplace. So rest assured about it. These examples of people being victimised, if you like, by the laws for refusing to somehow endorse or collaborate with same-sex marriage ceremonies or same-sex activities of some sort, they will become more commonplace in Australia. So it's in this environment that I just want you to take a deep breath and consider some of the following questions that I've posed. Why is it that we oppose same-sex marriage? What does religious liberty mean? How do discrimination laws operate? Now, in light of the answers to the above questions, where does the threat to religious liberty arise in the event of same-sex marriage? Now, when we put the question, why do you oppose same-sex marriage? Many religious believers and others state that marriage is a unique institution ordained by God to be a procreative union of one man and one woman. Often the damage done to the institution by heterosexuals is conveniently overlooked. The high divorce rate, the extent of infidelity, the high rate of births outside of marriage, and the very high incidence of cohabitation outside of marriage, these factors say nothing to support or strengthen the institution of marriage of one man and one woman. In America, what we've been told by very active and serious Catholics, that anything up to 64 of Catholics support same-sex marriage, that close to 70% of Catholic women use the contraceptive pill. You can see what it means in America, what it means in Australia. Yet the culture, Michael pointed out correctly, is different. In America, in the foreseeable future, there will be no president of the United States elected by the people who is not married. Unlike Gillard in Australia, or unlike any other person who goes to the prime ministership with some other lovers or whatever the case might be, it will not be quite as significant as what it would be in America if you are living outside of wedlock and seek to go for public office. In fact, many people held in high office in American politics have been forced to resign when it's been discovered that they have been cheating on their spouses or been having extramarital affairs elsewhere. So, if the preservation of marriage between one man and one woman is the main thrust of why we oppose same-sex marriage, then we are on very flimsy grounds. Think again why you oppose same-sex marriage and delve into what the natural order of creation has given us. That is, what is it that God created and what is the natural unity of that creation? The joining of man and woman conforms to the design of a body and the procreative instincts of human beings. Anything other than that is a violation of God, of God's creation. And that is the basis why we oppose same-sex marriage. The opposition is to avoid the state ever endorsing same-sex activity. Once the state says that same-sex activity in marriage or out of marriage as a sexual relationship is valid, then the game is lost. Now, Michael said that in Australia there is absolutely no distinction at law between people inside of marriage, outside of marriage, in a relationship or not in a relationship, but if they set up house together, what they do is their business. The state has stopped short of endorsing sexual activity outside of marriage so far, but recognises the union, the cohabitation side of it. When, and I say when, the state says that same-sex marriage is lawful, all of that changes, and so does everything else with it. So if we accept the basis of our opposition to same-sex marriage, then it follows that we do not approve of sex outside of the natural unity in marriage. That is, we don't approve of sex outside of marriage, be it of a homosexual type or of a heterosexual type. Why is that so? Well, clearly, if you approve of sexual activity for heterosexuals outside of marriage, then on what basis do you oppose sexual activity for homosexuals outside of marriage? Clearly, that is a prejudice. Why would you not be consistent if you say that your opposition is based on God's creation, that this is the nature of man and woman, they have a purpose and a function in life, that God's creation foresaw that for the regeneration? Then on what basis do you exclude some people and not others, particularly when those people you exclude are also creatures of God too? Bear that in mind. So from this, we establish why we act to oppose these sexual activities. In order to be consistent, in order to apply the valid argument and the groundy argument as to why those who have a religious belief should in fact be entitled to live in accordance with those beliefs. Now allow me to look just at what religious liberty means. I'd like you to forget everything you've read about it somewhere along the line, because what you'll find is there's an argument which, when boiled down, people say we have an absolute right to do whatever our religion tells us to do. For argument's sake, the father, the Muslim father of a 12-year-old girl who consented to his daughter getting married to a friend who was something like 20 years her senior, said he believed it was the will of Allah. Well, you see, that person may or may not be genuine, but taken at his word, he says he is following what his belief tells him to do. His religious belief tells him to do. So you can see there is no absolute entitlement here in terms of living by religious beliefs which lack proper grounding and proper explanation and plus proper logic and common sense. But in the context, religious belief is a search for truth, a search for God and what God wants of us. In this search, we look for the meaning of life. We ask if there is life after death. When a person perceives and acknowledges what it is that is more, then he is more than likely to grant that person life after death. That person orders his or her life in accordance with those perceptions. Their form of conduct will be consistent with what is required to please God in order that you can secure life after death, hopefully, or more likely to. Many people are guided and informed on these perceptions by church teachings. In their activities, religiously defined people will follow their conscience in order to come to God, the end and purpose of life. In following their conscience, people must not be coerced by the state or instruments of a state to violate their conscience. The Second Vatican Council document, Dignitatis Humanae, makes this very clear. In following conscientious belief, men and women must be free and immune from coercion. Now, examples of coercion is courts who apply what they say is the law of the land, which is the state acting through the courts to coerce you to comply with what they say is the law of the land. Hence the tension, therefore, when beliefs clash with discrimination laws, which direct that no individual or group can be denied goods and services. That photographer, that cake maker, that county court, all denied services to homosexual couples or homosexual weddings. So what that is a state saying you can't live in accordance with your conscience. So the cake maker, the photographer, the county clerk, the pizza maker. You may not have heard of this, but a person had a pizza shop, had been running for 9 years, and innocently, the wife of the owner said, "Oh, look, if we were ever asked to make pizzas for a same-sex wedding, we would refuse." So the campaign against that pizza shop was so strong, had forced the pizza shop to close down. The people of Indiana raised something like $440,000 in defence of a pizza shop, but they haven't reopened, to the best of my knowledge. As one of the homosexuals said, who in the hell would have a wedding ceremony and order pizzas for their guests? Which is a valid point, isn't it? Okay, so these sort of pizza makers, the B&B operators, limousine providers who are inspired by religious beliefs cannot at law deny a service to a homosexual couple or to a same-sex wedding ceremony. And if they do, then the law applies a penalty against them. That is a form of coercion. And that is a denial of religious liberty of people involved and engaged in this search for truth, for God. So discrimination laws are designed to make unlawful any act which results in unequal treatment of another or of a class of people. Discrimination laws do not tolerate exclusion and subordination of human beings who bear some characteristic or attribute such as race, colour, sex, social origin, religion, and other innumerable other factors. They just keep on expanding these discrimination laws to include all sorts of things. In promoting adoption rights for same-sex couples, the Victorian Labor Government's Equality Minister, Martin Foley, said just recently, "We are approaching this issue on the basis that we are seeking to remove discrimination from the Adoption Act. to be really clear, he said, about removing all forms of discrimination in the Act. Read between the lines. Although not said, what Foley was really saying, Christians in the main are discriminators. Christians in the main are full of prejudice. We cannot tolerate that if we want no discrimination. That is in reality what's been said. That is in reality what's been said all over the world, in England. Certainly it is quite common for Christians who go before the courts on numerous matters to in fact almost be accused directly of being discriminators. And in America it's becoming clearer now. So the usual response of many religious churches and groups is to seek an exemption from the operation of these laws, what they say is, but make allowances for us. Now, of course, logically, when you argue for exemptions, you are arguing for the right to discriminate. That's what you're doing. Governments sometimes accede to the exemptions, but qualify it by adding, and I quote, when acting for a religious purpose, or, I quote again, to avoid injury to the susceptibilities of adherents of a faith or of that faith. These qualifications for exemptions has shown more times than not that courts and tribunals in Australia overrule the exemptions because the impugned act is not taken in protection of a court teaching or does not come within the legal meaning of a religious purpose. Religious purpose is more than just saying, I am a believer, and therefore what I'm doing is for a religious purpose. Now, examples of how these exemption laws have been denied is seen in, I just mentioned two cases, the Queensland case of St. Vincent de Paul, where they would not allow a woman who was not a Catholic to hold the position of a president of a chapter. Because the rules of St. Vincent de Paul says, look, we are affiliated with the Catholic Church, we are inspired by the Catholic teachings, we want a Catholic to hold the position of a president of a particular region, of a chapter. Reason being, we want that person to say a prayer, we want that person to lead some spiritual discussion before meetings. The Discrimination Tribunal of Queensland said no. You can't insist that only a Catholic can hold that position. In fact, the woman who was elected unopposed was not sure if she was Christian or not. She in fact said she wasn't sure if she believed in the resurrection, but she was inspired by the work of St. Vincent de Paul, for which she had been a volunteer for many, many years. No doubt a very good woman. But St. Vincent de Paul wanted a Catholic for a specific purpose of promoting the idea of her own faith. The tribunal said, no, you are discriminating. There's no reason why a non-Catholic can't do that job as well as a Catholic. Totally misunderstand what religious liberty is all about. The other case was in Cobourg, more recently in Victoria. Christian Brethren organisation didn't want an outreach group which was promoting young people troubled by their sexuality and in some cases acknowledged as homosexuals have an accommodation at their resort centre in Phillip Island. One of their defences was, look, we say no because we believe that sex is within marriage of a man and a woman. Therefore, we are living up to our religious beliefs. And in fact, we have established this resort centre under our corporation as for religious purposes. The Court of Appeal said, not true. There is no religious purpose for what you are engaged in. You are running a commercial enterprise. Therefore, you can't refuse. I mean, that's a simplistic position of what the Court of Appeal said in Victoria. Again, this idea of protection under the law for exemption for specific purposes of your religious beliefs was just done over, bowled over, on the basis that it was not what you say it is. You're doing something for your own convenience. Now, the unsaid word was, you are prejudiced. You are discriminating against people of a sexual orientation, in the case of Kobol, in the case of St. Vincent de Paul, against other people of other religions. So, let me just move to the Kentucky town clerk, this Kim Davis. When refusing to issue the marriage license to same-sex couples, she argued, that she was following her conscience. The court, in response, said, yes, go to jail for that, and put her in jail. The result of a Supreme Court saying that every state must have same-sex marriages was that you can't deny a service to same-sex couples. Now, mind you, at least Kim Davis has an argument. What she said is, I am not stopping people from getting married. It's just in my position. My name is attached to every license that's issued by this county. I don't want my name to be used. Now, her argument in employment law would also be strong because when she took up the position, it wasn't a requirement for her to issue license to same-sex couples because marriage was not lawful to them. But the law has changed. And she says, well, I no longer wish to occupy that position where my name is used. But they wouldn't remove her name. I understand most of that is now settled by arrangement, but you see the complexities that are involved here. If it happened in Australia, more than likely, she would have been protected by the employment laws because the position she took was prior to the law changing. The employer may have been asked in Australia to change the roles in different ways, but not to adversely affect her. In America, that didn't apply because different laws apply. But she went to jail rather than breach her own conscience. Such is the force of this religious belief. So, are these sort of things likely to occur in Australia in the event of same-sex marriage? When same-sex marriage comes to Australia, again, forgive me for being a little bit more assertive on this, perhaps in 2017, what would be required to protect religious liberty? Fair question. Noises are already being raised that churches and religious individuals should be granted various exemptions to protect their teachings and conscientious beliefs. Some voices are heard to say that churches should withdraw from secular marriages and only perform church marriages. Now, with great respect, I think that's all they do now, isn't it? They don't perform marriages outside of church, although they've got the liberty to do so. The Marriage Act does not, at the moment, force any minister of religion to perform anything other than the service they choose to do. So the concessions of saying we will exempt ministers and so on is a bit of a nonsense, a bit of a furphy, because it's already there in law now. So it's my view, and I emphasise my view, we should not move for exemptions, as that is a sure way to become irrelevant to the public debate beyond same-sex marriage. The argument is that if the church has a mission, the church has a mission to all people to spread the truth as to what marriage is and what it's not. Once the state says, oh yes, look, you just concentrate on your own things, we'll worry about the rest, and we'll have two different forms of marriages, one secular and one religious, starts to render you irrelevant to the public debate as to what is marriage and why only one man and one woman. Rather, we should argue that acting on a religious conscience is a right, not an exemption. I'll just elaborate on that just a little bit for you. To act on a religious conscience is to uphold a belief, not an act of discrimination. So what we're doing, if you follow the logic, we say our religious belief is what we're trying to protect. If in the course of trying to protect our religious belief, people disagree, they have that right to disagree. But I should not be coerced. I should not be forced to give up that belief or to act on that belief. Why? Because the international instruments, the international law, all say that you can manifest your religious belief. Qualify just a little bit. But you can live in accordance with that belief. And you can uphold that belief. It is not an act of discrimination to live by that belief. The act of discrimination comes along when you say, oh, let me discriminate and you will make it lawful for me to discriminate. We're not interested in the area of discrimination. We're interested in living by what we believe to be a fundamental truth in our lives. That is how the public debate, hopefully, might be just turned a little bit by changing the language and changing the arguments away from discrimination to an area where international law, an international human rights instrument, supports your position. Now, to act out of religious belief is to assert our rights in international law and to enshrine human rights law. The alternative is to turn religious beliefs into a right to discriminate, a no-no as far as I'm concerned. And in fact, it's a position which, if granted, the state will be determined to eradicate over time. You will lose all your rights over time. So in asserting the right to act on a religious belief, is it not reasonable to accuse the believer, listen, because I'd like you to ponder on this, is it not reasonable to accuse the believer of merely acting with prejudice towards same-sex couples? Was the cake maker or the photographer refusing to deliver a service to a same-sex wedding acting with prejudice? Similarly, does a bed and breakfast operator refusing to give a double bed to two men act with prejudice or inconscience? These are the challenges ahead. Allow me to give an illustration. Just use a bit of imagination, because my wife says, no, I don't like it. And as a dutiful husband, who says that marriage is blissful at times, I couldn't disagree. But this illustration. A Christian motivated delivery driver in Australia has been asked to deliver a double bed and mattress to an address. Upon arrival at the address, the driver discovers that the double bed and mattress is for a same-sex couple. Would the driver be justified in refusing to complete the delivery? Now, what's the essential difference between that delivery driver, the photographer, the cake maker? The cake maker, by the way, is not as simplistic as what I said. What the real issue in the cake maker was not the baking of a cake, but the icing sugar on top that was going to symbolise locking rings, to symbolise the wedding, the same-sex wedding. That's what the cake maker refused to place on top of the cake. It wasn't the issue of a cake as such. But what's the essential difference when you take those examples? Where does genuine belief cut in? And where does prejudice cut in? If a genuine belief is that you have acted across the board, like I said at the start, that we oppose sex outside of marriage in whatever form, then you've got a stronger argument. But if you're just doing it for one group and not another, then your argument is not as clear. So you'll need to think about these things as we get further and further along the path of what we're asking for. The immediate question which will arise is, to what extent will the state insist that faith-based schools must teach that same-sex marriage is the equivalent of heterosexual marriage? Now, these are the questions that will arise when we have same-sex marriage. Can schools continue to teach that only man and woman is a valid marriage? Or will schools be forced to say, yes, but there's also a valid marriage between two men or two women? What is it that they will be allowed to teach according to the law? And to what extent can a priest get up in a pulpit on a Sunday and preach against the evilness of same-sex activity or same-sex marriage? These are unresolved questions for the time being, but they become critical if you want to preserve your teachings of your faith. What is it that we teach, and what is it that is permitted to say to our young people? To what extent will the state insist that government funding for religious-run agencies is dependent on complying with Commonwealth policy? Example is that if a government says, look, we provide some assistance for adoption centres, such as in Victoria. If you want to continue to run your adoption centre and receive our funding to assist you, then you have to comply with government policy. And if government policy is that we allow same-sex adoption, then you have to allow that. And if you don't allow that, we will remove funding from you. Now, a very, very long bow. Catholic schools receive an enormous amount of funding from governments. Will the government have a political will at some stage, when same-sex marriage is established, turn around and say to the Catholic authorities, you must teach what the state permits, that is, same-sex marriage and religious marriages? You can't exclude one or the other if you continue to want to receive our funding. Now, mind you, the Gillard government already established a very dangerous precedent in that very area when it amended the Sex Discrimination Act back in 2013, if I remember correctly, before the election of the current government. Gillard's government said that religious-based or faith-based home care centres could no longer refuse accommodation to two people of the same sex in the one room. In other words, religious organisations wanted to exercise a discretion and say, yes, look, we're charitable, we're generous, we wish to provide care, we will provide two single rooms to two men who'd been up until now in a relationship. That right was removed by the Gillard government. Faith-based home care centres now do not have such a discretion. If they have the room, they must provide a room with a double bed to two people of the same sex, if they want to continue to receive government funding. So the precedent has already been set. It is there in law. How far that's expanded, we're not likely to see the effects of that until we have same-sex marriage. Now, over here, I've got two papers. One paper is called Welcome to the New Hollywood. In that paper, the point I make right at the end of it is that the next campaign after same-sex marriage will be gender identity, that is transsexualism. That has already taken off in England and in the US. That is the next equality argument that will come after same-sex marriage. Transsexual equality. The other one is a submission to the Senate Legal and Constitutional Affairs Committee just recently, where the question was, should Australia have a plebiscite or a referendum in terms of resolving this same-sex marriage debate? And we made a submission, and the point essentially is to also say, what's wrong with having a referendum? One of the points is that a referendum changes the Constitution, and the Constitution is not a law-making document. The Constitution is a power-granting document, not a law-making. So it doesn't define the law as such. That's a function for the High Court. But it's there for you to take, and I'm sure, Michael, you'll probably be anxious to answer any questions that might arise as well. We're happy to take questions. Thank you very much.
That was Rocco Mimo with Redefining Marriage, Its Impact on Religious Liberty. This talk was hosted by the St. Thomas More Society, the Ambrose Centre for Religious Liberty, and the Australian Catholic Students Association. And for more talks, interviews, and shows, visit cradio.org.au.